Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 365th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormick, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at, as always, the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. Now, James, 365, that means one for every day of the year.
That's right. And you know what, Mike? You know this. We are closing in on our 10th anniversary. And by anniversary, I don't mean that we are married.
Although, yeah.
It just feels like it.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
So let's move on. I'm going to have today we have Tony Nikinchuk on the podcast with us. I'm going to have Tony introduce himself, and then I'm going to tell you why he's on.
Sure. Tony. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm Tony Nikinchuk. I'm a pharmacist from Peace River, Alberta. It's pretty far north of Edmonton, and I'm a hospital pharmacist there in my day job.
All right. So, Tony, years ago, we at the PIPE conference, we had talked a number of times about the social determinants of health and how, in many ways, they're more meaningful than a lot of what we do in medicine if we want to actually improve health outcomes for people. And that led people to begin to question, what are the social determinants of health, which our group keeps preaching about. Now, Tony's been involved with us for a long time. Mike Kolber, who we've had on the podcast, comes from Peace River, and that's the connection to Tony. And we managed to wrangle him into all sorts of things like tools for practice. He's the lead or co-lead on the pricing document, which is for all of Alberta. He's a big part of our PIPE conference, speaks there every year and runs or helps run the committee. So really has played a huge role. And we assigned him the most difficult of all the topics this year, which was social determinants of health.
Yeah.
And it was done so well, I wanted him to come on. So he happens to be down in Edmonton. I can say that because we're right around Halloween. And I tried to get him on. So here he is today to talk about the social determinants of health. And Tony, feel free to start to take us through.
Sure. Yeah, as Mike said, this was kind of one of the topics as a committee. We kind of go through suggested topics from the attendees at the conference and then sort of decide on that and other topics we might be interested in, which ones we'll cover in the next year's conference. And this was like the one everyone wanted to cover, but no one wanted to actually do. So I just thought, well, you know, I'll do this. And then it turned out well, because I have a weird personal hobby of just doing statistical analysis and graphs. And it turned out there was a lot of that to be done with this talk as well. So I had a lot of fun putting it together too, and learned quite a bit in the process. So we're just going to kind of go through the presentation I did and just sort of organically discuss it as questions come up between the three of us. And so I guess I'll first just jump into what the social determinants of health are. And organizations like the World Health Organization have, you know, spent months in probably multiple committees coming to these consensus definitions of what social determinants of health are, but they're not very useful. The definition essentially comes down to...
You're saying that a committee of people got together and their product wasn't useful.
It's very surprising, I know.
I know.
But that's what happened. And this definition really leaves you just grasping at straws, looking for what
means. Let's read it.
Sure. So the World Health Organization says social determinants of health are the conditions in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age, and the wider set of forces and systems shaping the conditions of daily life. These forces and systems include economic policies and systems, development agendas, social norms, social policies, and political systems. So it's a definition that the social determinants of health are everything. And that's
stuff happens.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, stuff happens in your life and it affects your health. So I presented this graphic at the conference, and it's basically these three little racers, and they start off at the starting line, at the same starting line, and one of them is going much faster than the other two, and the finish line is a health outcome, so to speak. And the other two, one of them's bogged down by a rock on their back, and there's three little bumps in her way. And then the third one, he's not only got a huge rock on his back, he's got an uphill plank he has to go up first, and then he's got three hurdles in his way. And it just represents that there are a lot of things getting people from the beginning of life to a particular health outcome that kind of have nothing to do with their biology, say, the genetics, as well as, in a lot of cases, nothing to do with the care they receive. And a lot of it has to do with sort of the socioeconomic barriers that are put in their way, access to medical care, and other things that we'll talk about for the rest of it. So that's kind of what I boil it down to.
And, yeah, and the reason that this is... Go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead, James. No, you go.
And I was going to say, and why it's important, you know, because we whenever we present sort of evidence in the previous 364 podcasts, you know, there's huge assumptions that, one, people are similar to who are in the study, but also that they have access to these things, that they don't have these rocks on their backs, that they have adequate food, that they have adequate living circumstances, and so on, because those are the people who are typically enrolled in clinical trials. Obviously, there's a few, you know, types of clinical trials, you know, whether they have to do with, you know, people with florid schizophrenia and so on, that aren't quite like that. But in general, the people who are enrolled in trials are, you know, do not necessarily have all of the hurdles that many people have in place. And that's why we thought it would be of value to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can go ahead, Mike.
And I was just going to say, like, there's a really great board game for people to get a concept of the social determinants of health. It's called The Last Straw. And it's called that because you will only play it one time. it's a very sad game. So you start out and you end up with a spot in life that you might be a single mom, or you might be born to a single mom and have, and that in and of itself is not a great deal, but we know that there's more stresses in that family potentially, and then of a different ethnic group, of different race, and all of those kind of things. And you kind of draw these cards and then you try and play the game, but you start already having multiple kind of barriers in front of you, like, can you attend higher education, how quickly can you get a mortgage, living arrangements, and those kind of things. And pretty soon it becomes quite clear that your health, and if you're fortunate enough in the game to be a Caucasian male, and you come down with an illness, you can easily access care and get over that illness where the others can't. And it's a really informative game about learning around the social determinants of health and how, and we're just even now really getting a better grips of that. If you look at the management of sore throat, there's lots of recommendations around sore throat right now that maybe we don't need to treat every strep throat because very few of them ever get rheumatic heart disease anymore. And while that's true, we know that in certain populations, and Bruce would know this well, in the Maori population, the risk of developing rheumatic heart disease is much, much higher than baseline. And it's not necessarily about the access to antibiotics. It's also a lot about the social environment, the number of people to a bedroom, all of those kind of things, because they're living in close arrangements. And so there's so much going on in health that occurs, and we know that from our patients. They're, when you're sending them for a test that you think is important, but they don't seem to attend, why is that? And it's because of all of the other barriers in their life. And this is, it's such a huge part. We've never really talked about it in depth in the podcast. And so that's really what Tony's here for.
Yeah. And I want to mention, I will get into it a little later in terms of how social determinants affect research, but I think it also flips both ways, James. You know, you mentioned the people that are recruited to clinical trials. We don't often think of their socioeconomic status, but it goes the other way too. Like, if you look at a lot of trials of, say, like travel medicine type stuff, so the trials for the cholera vaccine, the one they market for traveler's diarrhea, if you look at the studies that they got the marketing license for that product on, they were on, like, kids and women in Bangladeshi slums, mm-hmm. who were living in conditions where cholera was basically endemic. And that's a pretty big leap to go from that to, like, wealthy, healthy, you know, white North Americans that are traveling for leisure.
Yeah, no,
right?
Totally.
And the evidence just isn't there for that use in that case. So I did present this slide at the PEEP conference, and it was basically from, I think it was from Kaihai, And it kind of looked at what determines what makes Canadians sick. And I think somewhat soberingly for physicians, about half of it was the person's life and the conditions around their life. And this was a lot of things, but throughout the presentation, I sort of pull out and focus on income, education, employment, housing, and then in Canada, Aboriginal status as well, or First Nations status. And I did point out that income sort of underpins almost everything else. Absolutely. So low income is the one thing that tends to be common among individuals who also have low status in the other areas as well. About 25% is your healthcare, so your access to your healthcare, the healthcare system, your wait times. Then 15% is your biology, and then 10% is your environment, so air quality, civic infrastructure, that sort of thing. So, I mean, if you look at that, about 75% of what is affecting your patient's health is sort of determined before they even walk through the door of your clinic. So I think it's sobering in a sense that we have to know the limitations of what we can achieve, but also, too, it gives us more empathy as well to realize that, you know, a lot of things that are impacting them are sort of beyond their control, and we have to take those into consideration.
It's interesting because
I was going to say, it's sort of like, you know, healthcare is and I'm exaggerating a bit, but to suggest it's almost like, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, you know.
Yeah,
I think we have a little bit more of an impact than that, but it's really important to realize, you know, that, you know, you can. Can you imagine where statins fit in this? I mean, it's such a small percentage of anything that we're doing, and they are effective in quotation marks. And Mike, I'm pretty sure that, you know, when you see, or pretty much any healthcare provider sees people, you know, they are not tremendously focusing on income, education, employment, and so on. There's definitely healthcare providers who do that, but it's not the majority of them.
No, and what I found interesting about that, what Tony just went through, is here we are spending so much time talking about an investment right now in precision medicine, which focuses on the 15% or so that's biology related to health, and ignores the other 85%. Right? It's just fascinating. How are we going to fix healthcare with precision medicine, rather than looking at all of these other parameters that we know drive health so much more?
Yeah, like
that's
going to
be another podcast.
Yeah, we're spending money developing drugs that target specific genetic mutations within small portions of the population. And you're like, well, what about income equality? And like, wow, we can't fix that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating how we got to this state. But anyhow, let's keep going.
So I did want to touch on methodology a bit, because I think listeners of this podcast would be used to hearing certain standards of evidence when presenting a lot of these topics, and randomized controlled trials are typically sort of the gold standard underpinning a lot of that. And I actually had to email Colbert when I was putting this presentation together and just say, like, hey, am I missing something here? Because I am not finding any RCTs on this stuff. And with the exception of maybe two or three little kind of pilot RCTs, there's just nothing out there. So a lot of this relies on population-based cohort studies. So I think the limitation of that is that causality is sometimes difficult to determine. Some studies try by sort of looking at the temporal relationship of the factors. So if you know the determinant comes before the outcome, we sort of can safely assume that there's at least some causal link there between the determinant and the outcome. But it's hard to concretely do that. So it is a limitation. I'll just jump into my lung cancer analogy quickly, and then you guys can comment on this. Yeah. I kind of thought back to the early days of the lung cancer debate around cigarette smoking, and there really was never any like RCTs that were done that were like, oh, here, you smoke and you don't smoke, and we'll see how many of you develop lung cancer. It was sort of a convergence of all these different pieces of evidence that led to the, you know, pretty concrete conclusion that cigarettes are a huge risk factor for lung cancer. And that was from things like animal studies that we often discount in medical research, cellular pathology, individual chemical research on some of the carcinogenic substances. And then the biggest thing that was kind of the not the final straw, so to speak, but what tied it all together was the robust population-based research. But at the same time, the tobacco companies were funding pretty aggressive PR campaigns against that research and casting doubt on it because, oh, it's just population research. You can't link it to cause and all these things. And even as late as the 60s, public polls at the time said that only 40% of the public believe smoking is a cause of lung cancer, and only a third of doctors. So there were actually fewer doctors than just like general lay public that believed that link. And it might be because at the same time, over 40% of doctors were regular smokers as well. So it might be that that human fallacy of not wanting to admit what you're doing is wrong, even though you know it probably is.
And you know what's really interesting about that sort of analogy is, not, you're just talking about lung cancer. I mean, there is, you know, there really isn't any... You know, unless you live in abject poverty, you have zero food, you have absolutely no drinkable water, you know, your sanitation is abysmal. There's not much worse you can do than smoke. I mean, and it's fascinating that it took so long to try to figure that out, because you've just talked about lung cancer. You know, you've got the chronic obstructive lung disease, you've got heart disease, you've got all many other different types of cancer. And you know, it is difficult, especially when you've got certain people against you in like sort of the tobacco companies, to get enough information out there to convince the populace. And so, you know, when you're trying to look at, you know, more nuanced things of you know, day-to-day life, it is trickier. And it's just a great example is the smoking one.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so I'll just kind of touch on the next topic. And I sort of was going to use this as a preamble in the talk, but I just didn't have enough time to cover all my slides. But essentially, it's just a bit of a summary of how different advanced economies rate against one another in terms of outcomes. But also, it was just part of a way to sort of illustrate that the United States is an outlier in a lot of ways. I don't mean to put down their system. It's got its goods and its bads, but their healthcare spending is substantially higher than any other OECD nation, like pretty much double the OECD average per capita. And it's been growing faster over the last 30 years or so than it has been in the other OECD nations. To be clear, it's been growing in all nations, but it's been growing at a much faster rate in the US. And the problem with that, and the reason we bring it up, there's a couple reasons I bring it up. One is that they don't get a concurrent increase in positive outcomes. In fact, they're quite outside of their OECD counterparts on multiple health outcomes, but also health system outcomes as well. So they're not exactly getting a lot of good return on investment. But the other reason I wanted to bring it up at the presentation, and I touched on it a bit, was it was a Canadian audience. And because we're next door to the United States, and because they are an outlier in that way, the temptation among Canadians sometimes is to say, well, our system's not like, we're so much better. Yeah. There's this Canadian superiority complex.
I thought it was the American superiority complex. I mean, wrong.
In this way, Tony's right. In this way, we like to think of ourselves as special and unique and really setting a standard.
Yeah, and I think the thing that frustrates me about it is it also precludes people from having honest discussions about our system. Because as soon as we bring up any sort of like reasonable reform, they're like, well, our health system's the best. We can't do that, right? Yeah. And so I think we have to be realistic with ourselves that, you know, we're not a world leader in healthcare anymore. No. In fact, in a lot of ways, we're not really that far ahead of the U.S. We're in the bottom third of the Commonwealth Fund rankings, and the U.S. is ranked last. The Commonwealth Fund did that, not me, so you can go after them. But Canada ranks very close to the U.S. in a lot of these attributes, so I just kind of wanted to point that out, just because I think we're almost raised in Canada with that notion that our system is just like uniquely superior to all other systems, and it's just not the case. Maybe it once was, but it isn't anymore for sure. Yeah. So the areas I think where the U.S. is probably the biggest outlier is the health outcomes, but Canada's not so great on that either. They're third last in health outcomes in the Commonwealth Fund rankings, which if you ever haven't looked them up, the Commonwealth Fund is really, really interesting. They rank basically, I think it's 14 or 15 advanced economies in terms of their not only their health system efficiency, but the equity in the system, the health outcomes, the access, that sort of thing. We have a pretty good care process in Canada, as does the U.S. And then, interestingly, the efficiency in the U.S. system is the second lowest out of all those countries. Canada's isn't all that bad, which also goes against some popular assumptions out there. Yeah. So, yeah, just to, I guess, challenge the sort of popular stance on some of these issues before we get into that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mentioned before the four main determinants I looked at in approaching this presentation were educational attainment. So that can range from how many average years of schooling does a person have to how far in education does the average citizen get. They're kind of ranked differently depending on where you look. Income, generally basically just household income. Employment is literally the employment rate when we're looking at most of these things. So how many people are employed as a percentage of the workforce. So this isn't a percentage of the whole population, but the people that can actually, you know, legally work. And then housing. And housing was a bit tricky to look at because there's so many different definitions. Some is like, you know, people per room. Others are, you know, percentage of houses requiring major repairs to make them.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually the main metric they use in the Canadian data is the percentage of houses requiring major repairs to be considered like acceptable housing. And because the data sets for some of those things were most complete for those, I used those when I was analyzing some of the research. That is one thing that's tricky about this area is the data is a bit all over the place and patchy when you're trying to compare different countries too.
Yep.
And different researchers approach it from different angles. And it's, so it is a bit of a hot mess putting it all together. Mm-hmm. So I tried to do the best I could. So we talked about this initially and sort of how social determinants aren't just something we need to be looking at as clinicians, but also as researchers too and people analyzing research. Because I think in ignorance of social determinants and just totally excluding it from our analyses leads to some spurious conclusions possibly. So there was a really interesting study done in the American Heart Journal, and it was a prospective cohort study of coronary heart disease outcomes. And what they did was they took this group, they predicted their 10-year coronary heart disease outcomes based on Framingham calculation. But they broke them up into two groups. One was a higher economic status group and one was a lower economic status group. And just based on the Framingham calculations alone, they had almost identical risks. So it's about 3.7% and 3.9%. When they added a sort of component to the Framingham model that accounted for socioeconomic status, the 10-year outcomes for higher economic status individuals were just above 3%, whereas for the lower socioeconomic status people, it was just above 5%. So the difference was much wider. And they then compared that to the actual observed outcomes in those cohort when they followed them over 10 years. And the outcomes when you considered the socioeconomic status were much more closely aligned with the actual outcomes. So they were 3.2% for the higher status individuals and 5.6%. So there's much less error in those predictions when you considered economic status. So I thought that was a pretty interesting study to look at.
That's fascinating because the original estimates would have taken into account things like smoking and pre-existing diabetes and all of that. So that's not what's driving this. When they added the socioeconomic status, it was really education and income and those kind of things. And that was a better predictor, it turned out, than a lot of the other things. And James, you know that most times when you add anything to a predictive model, it doesn't really help that much.
Yeah, no, and this is helping. And again, I'm going to use relative numbers. It's, you know, the difference between those two numbers, you know, we're looking at, you know, 60-70% different, you know, 3.1 yeah. versus 5.2. And one, there's very few things that increase risk that much. Even smoking doesn't. And we have virtually nothing that reduces risk by that much.
You're yeah. right, nothing.
You know, so, you know, it really shows that, you know, if in fact these cohort data are providing information that, you know, of that it's a causation thing, it's really important that we can never prove causation with this, but yeah. and it's, you know, it's a hodgepodge of a bunch of things, but it's impressive enough that you kind of go, you just become depressed and go, why are we even doing healthcare? But that's another story.
Mm-hmm. We'll get into your therapy issues.
Yes,
later.
Exactly.
Deck chairs on the Titanic. So the WHO, of course, came up in a lot of this. The World Health Organization, they do a lot of work on this stuff. They have to have work to do. So then in 2011, they released this 25 by 25 initiative. And what it was a plan to cut mortality from non-communicable diseases by 25% by 2025. And their initial initiative just looked at conventional risk factors, so smoking, diabetes, hypertension, those sorts of things that we focus on relatively frequently in our practices. But it totally sort of just didn't consider socioeconomic status. And so these researchers in Lancet in March 2017 wanted to look at how would things have changed if the WHO had looked at socioeconomic status. And this is a pretty interesting study. It was pretty huge. They looked at a cohort of over 1.5 million people, and this was in high-income countries. So this was looking at differences between, you know, relatively similar countries, representing over 25 million person years, which is a pretty massive sample size. And so, yeah, they wanted to know if the socioeconomic status had as much of an impact as other risk factors. And their aim was sort of to determine whether maybe those factors should be a focus of interventional efforts and public policy changes in wealthy countries. And so they had a great chart in there that I just kind of broke down in the presentation. And what they did in this study is they wanted to look at what's known as the population attributable fraction. And so basically the way you break this down is if they're looking at something like smoking, for example, and they were looking at the outcome of premature mortality. So these are people that die before the expected life expectancy. And if you're looking at something like smoking, what portion of the premature mortality in that population can be attributed to that risk factor? So what portion of premature deaths is caused by smoking? And so this study broke it down that for men, about 30% of premature mortality was attributable to smoking, about 20% in women. Physical activity is about 25% in men and 23% in women. And by that, I mean, of course, physical inactivity, sorry. Socioeconomic status was actually the third highest when they put it among the other risk factors. It was only lower than smoking and physical inactivity. And they calculated that roughly 20% of premature mortality among men was attributable to socioeconomic status and 15% for women. Hypertension, diabetes, and high alcohol intake came in further below them. And then interestingly, obesity, it was a pretty small component. It was about 4% for women. And in men, it actually had like a protective effect. it was actually a negative number, but it was a non-statistically significant finding. So essentially, obesity had no effect in men on premature mortality. And the other thing I find interesting, though, and I'll talk about this in a future slide, is that socioeconomic status alone can be attributed to premature mortality about 20%, right? But things like smoking, high alcohol intake, hypertension, diabetes, some of these things themselves have also been linked to lower socioeconomic status, right? And so here they're essentially just pulling out the impact of the socioeconomic status. We're kind of ignoring the fact that some of these risk factors occur more frequently in individuals with low socioeconomic status.
And as well, they selected countries where people are relatively well-to-do already. So it's interesting. This is, when you look at this outcome, they've already picked the best potential candidates and they've picked the best, and they've already kind of separated the risk factors that may travel with it. So this is the least impact socioeconomic status can have if their estimations are correct.
So yeah, no, exactly. And it just goes to point, you know, that we were talking about how, you know, how bad smoking is, how we need to be physically active, and how much it doesn't matter, relatively speaking, things like, you know, hypertension and diabetes, and even if we could eliminate those You know, with our treatments, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference overall, and it's one of the reasons why we don't see big differences when we treat these things. And these are you know, in the studies that look at hypertension and diabetes, these are people who do have it. It's not, you know, so if anyone is going to benefit, it would be those people. And the whole thing about obesity, Mike, you know, we've talked about this, I think, you know, probably a year and a half ago or 2 years ago on the podcast about the evidence for obesity. And a lot of it depends on actually how you define obesity. Because I don't think anyone would argue that, you know, morbid obesity is clearly a health risk for more than just cardiovascular disease. But, you know, for quality of life and joint damage and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, being overweight is not, from everything I can find, it doesn't appear to be.
Yeah.
And even when you get to BMIs of 30, 31, 32, the risk associated with it is not so much that one would go, wow, that's really something. So I think why we're not maybe picking it up in this sort of thing is that, you know, we fortunately don't have that many people who are morbidly obese. And maybe that's why, and again, I guess it probably depends on the definition. If only very morbidly obese people have major health risks, then when you just look simply at obesity, maybe it just doesn't register that much.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the low down in the obesity scale, like mild and overweight, probably don't have much. Yeah. That makes up the majority of that obesity or mm-hmm. overweight pyramid. And so it's kind of washed out, and you don't see those effects from the morbid obesity people because they're relatively infrequent compared to the base of the pyramid. All right.
Okay, perfect. So I talked about income, education, employment, housing as being sort of the major determinants I was going to focus on. I get more to the employment, and we'll get more to that in maybe the next episode, because I'll just look at an analysis of different countries. There, it was tough to find evidence on employment, and it was also tough to find evidence on housing, actually. I did do some research for someone this week because they had asked me about it, and there is some evidence out there, and not surprisingly, you know, poor housing leads to pretty poor health outcomes. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to understand that with a lot of this research, a lot of these determinants kind of go together, and they all kind of travel along with one another. But we'll touch on that in the next discussion. So next I'll just talk about education, because there is quite a bit more research out there about that. And this study done in 2008 in the New England Journal, it was an analysis of 3.5 million deaths in 16 different European countries. And they looked at kind of European countries across the spectrum. So it wasn't just like super high-income European countries. They included Eastern Europe as well. And in total, basically what they did is they compared the total deaths per 100,000 person years, so it'd be like a death rate. In total, there were about 1,300 more deaths per 100,000 person years for the lowest education population versus the highest education population. So they would call that the education gap in the mortality rate. And I think to give a little bit of perspective on those numbers, basically the rate of deaths attributable to smoking in Canada, for example, is about 125 deaths per 100,000. So that gives you sort of an idea of the magnitude of these numbers. Because I think when we see that, 1333 per 100,000, it's kind of a small chunk of 100,000, right? But when you compare it to other known risk factors, it compares pretty largely.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think now part of it is because we don't, and I'd have to go back and look at this exact data, but we have everybody has a level of education, but not everybody is smoking. So
that's right.
So that's probably why, you know, it plays more of an impact, but it doesn't minimize the absolute importance of these sort of social determinants.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, because they're looking at the whole population here, right, per 100,000 in the population. So, yeah, not everyone in the population smokes. So, of course, that number is going to be smaller. So there is a prevalence issue there. But just to give people, because when you look at these numbers, they seem kind of abstract at first glance. So just to give people a sort of something to base that number on and to tie it to. What was interesting about this study, though, is that it did mask some pretty big regional differences within Europe. I pulled out a few of the interesting ones that I thought were quite neat to look at. And one of the ones was that Northern and Western Europe had a much smaller education gap. And a lot of that has to do with them being, you know, a little bit more advanced. They didn't spend quite a few years under communism during the Cold War. So they're more equal societies in general. And they had a difference of about 800 deaths per 100,000 person years. Eastern Europe, on the other hand, which are still just relatively emerging from the Cold War, right? There's still a lot of inequality there. They had a gap of about 2,200 deaths, which is a huge gap. And that kind of fits with the overall inequality in those nations. What was really interesting is that the Mediterranean countries, so like Italy and Spain, Greece, the differences due to education, it really were almost not there, because there's very little inequality in death from cardiovascular disease. And they kind of postulated in the paper that probably has to do with other factors that we sort of know of already, like their lifestyle in general, their diet, maybe some of their genetics. And we see that in research, like with the Mediterranean diet as well. They have sort of lower cardiovascular disease numbers than we would expect based on some other things we know about cardiovascular disease.
It's 100% due to the extra virgin olive oil. You heard it here totally first.
Yeah. Well, thank you, James, for that very insightful fake news.
James has to disclose that he is about to come out with the James McCormick brand olive oil soon.
Yes, exactly.
Extra virgin, ironically.
Yeah, ironically.
What's interesting here is that 1,300 boils down to 1.3%, which is the kind of thing you might see in a prevention trial in cardiovascular disease, and you'd go, wow, that's pretty good.
Right, yeah.
And this is the actual education gap.
So income, as I said, probably the most research out there is on income, and there's a lot of it out there. So I just tried to find a few of the studies that I found most interesting, and there was a really good study in JAMA in 2016. It was enormous, and they got access to 1.4 billion de-identified tax records, and then they were able to match them to Social Security death records. And so they basically were able to look at these people's income over their life, and then, you know, when did they die, at what age, and that sort of thing. So it's a pretty huge study, and it was done over the time period of about 14 years, from 2001 to 2014. And in this case, the gap in life expectancy between the poorest 1% and the wealthiest 1% was almost 15 years for men, and it was around 10 years for women. That's a remarkable life expectancy gap in a, you know, one of the wealthiest nations in the world. This is American data. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. I was really struck by that gap. In fairness to the research, this is the poorest 1%. A lot of times when you look at income research, they look at, say, the top 20% and the bottom 20%. So they are pulling out the poorest of the poorest Americans, mm-hmm. and the wealthiest of the wealthy Americans. So that gap is nonetheless impressive, I think.
Yeah, 10 to 15 years gap is a massive gap in life expectancy. And the de-identified tax records, of course, would not have included Trump's records.
No. He decided not to disclose those to the researcher.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the good thing about it is that, you know, as you can imagine, 98% of us are not in those categories. So,
right.
So, you know, it's kind of like what we do with nutritional research, is that when you compare extremes, the outcomes actually appear to be quite different. But nonetheless, you know, the data is also clear that there are differences. You don't have to be the lowest versus the highest 1%. It's on a continuum.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and they did look over the sort of a time period as well, and they looked at the life expectancy changes over time. And here they were comparing the top 5% with the bottom 5%. And what they found is that both groups did gain life expectancy in those 14 years, but those gains were accrued unequally. So the wealthiest 5% sort of gained more years of life expectancy than the bottom 5% did. So they're sort of having the bottom 5% sort of having slower progress in gaining life expectancy over time.
Wow.
And then what was also interesting was they looked at not just wealthy versus poor, but they also looked at low-income individuals between different regions. So they looked within the low-income population, what, again, sort of makes their life expectancy different between different regions of the United States. And they found a few interesting correlations. And again, we can argue about causation, but these are quite interesting. Obviously, there was a negative correlation for the low-income areas that had the poor health behaviors, so especially smoking. So the higher rates, obviously, the poor life expectancy. And then there was a positive correlation. So some of the effect of income alone was attenuated by these issues. And one of them was the local area fraction of immigrants, the fraction of college graduates, which I think that one intuitively makes sense to me, because these college graduates, you're always low income when you're a college graduate, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily low socioeconomic status.
Right.
Because a lot of these folks come from higher socioeconomic status homes, right? And then government expenditures as well. So basically, the more government spent on government programs, the less impact of income on the life expectancy of the individuals in that area. So yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's fascinating,
as well.
Right? Especially the government expenditures. When we talk all the time about how our healthcare costs are growing and where we should really be spending our money. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of pouring more money into healthcare without looking at these kind of aspects of life, how we can improve the quality of life and longevity through other means.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more next time. I do have a study that covers that and sort of the impact of those different areas of spending. And it's not so much that throwing money at the problem doesn't solve it, it's that we're kind of throwing it in the wrong areas.
For sure.
So we'll talk about that in the next episode. And then just last, I wanted to touch on something, and this comes up as criticism of social determinants of health research. And the criticism is that, well, all you're doing is picking up differences in health behaviors between socioeconomic groups. And so, of course, they're less healthy because they smoke more or whatever. And that's sometimes the argument. And so there was these two studies that looked at two cohorts. One was in Britain and then one was in France. And these researchers in PLOS Med compared these two cohorts and the findings that they had, and then sort of talked about the significance of them. And both of these cohorts had strong socioeconomic gradients for mortality. So meaning that, you know, people in higher status died later than individuals in lower status. But interestingly, in the British cohort, when they looked at the poor health behaviors, they were closely associated with economic status. And so when they controlled for poor health behaviors, the differences in mortality based on status alone were mostly eliminated, except for cardiovascular disease mortality. They kind of pulled that out as a one where the relationship still existed, but it was attenuated quite substantially. The French cohort, there wasn't much difference in the behaviors between the status groups. And so the differences in mortality remained even after you control for poor behaviors. And people ask, well, why does that matter? And part of the conclusion in this paper was that it matters because it determines where we might focus our public policy attention to. And if you know that poor health behaviors and their differences in economic status groups are what are driving premature mortality, then you look at intervening in educational ways, say, and
right.
educating the public on positive health behaviors. If you know that the behaviors don't really differ, then you're looking at more sort of socioeconomic policy interventions like housing initiatives and income support and those sorts of things. So
yeah,
it's
education, right?
So it's an important question, especially from a policy perspective, I think. But yeah, there certainly are situations in which the health behaviors are quite different between income groups and status groups. And there are countries in which it's not. And from the research I did, just for interest's sake, in Canada, probably the biggest difference was the smoking prevalence in the different economic status groups. The other health behaviors were pretty similar between groups, not different enough that it made much of an impact. But we'll talk about that next time.
You know, so this is really cool stuff. I mean, it just shows you how many different things impact, you know, what ultimately happens to us over a lifetime. And you know, how little some of the things that we do in healthcare have an impact. There's no doubt that we have lots of great impacts in healthcare, but, you know, this is why when it comes to a government perspective, it's so difficult to know where the best place is to put money, because, you know, if you talk about, well, we should educate people and, you know, about health issues, I mean, that's fraught with problems. Most, you know, it's very few, it's not like people don't know smoking's bad for them.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I know. Again, Mike, you obviously didn't pay attention to the first part of the podcast. But, you know, so it's not like people are going, what, I should be physically active? You know, this is not shocking news to anybody. And so it doesn't really have to do so much with education, but it's you know, what is it that drives people to do or not do these things that we're talking about? And you know, Mike, as well as I do, and you, and same with you, Tony, I mean, trying to influence what people do. And it kind of goes back to that podcast that we just had with Bruce about how do you get people to change habits? And there's no drug that does that, really.
No, and you get a lot into interventions, like even in terms of civic infrastructure, like how we build our cities and are they walkable? And because in order to change habits, you almost have to be the path of least resistance, right? The default has to be the healthy behavior. And in a lot of situations, the areas where people live, that's not the case. The healthiest behavior takes some work and time and effort. And like I've heard it said before, you know, we talk about death by 1,000 cuts. It's like change by 1,000 interventions, right?
Oh, for sure.
And you make a bunch of little changes and eventually that healthy behavior is the default and becomes much easier. But yeah, it's not an easy solution, like just putting out some, you know, public information announcements.
I know. And I think that's it. Many people get very frustrated that the solutions aren't simple, but the problems are complex. So why would the solutions be simple? So it's a fascinating thing. And I think I'm very glad we got you on, Tony, to talk about this and to go over some of these. We're going to do at least one more podcast on this, because we want to talk about some of the other issues that we haven't got to, like what can be done and other research showing where things are successfully done. But James, what do you want to sell? You want to sell?
No, just like I say, and
olive oil and
yeah, but that's later. But but it just shows you, I mean, there is lots of evidence in this area. It's not the typical evidence that we look at from a randomized controlled trials, but there is lots of evidence and it's as good as we'll ever get. And so we need to pay attention to this. And like I said, it is somewhat depressing given, you know, the things that we are sort of outside of the control of a person who comes in and talks to you for 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And James, just on that point, like I'll just tell listeners, when I was researching this topic, I had a page of PubMed links that I kind of filtered through, right? And so there was tons of research out there. I had to kind of filter out what was interesting for one and maybe applicable to an audience, right? But yeah, there's tons of that information out there.
No, cool. So yeah, so we'll pick this up at the next podcast. So as always, we just let you know about what we're going to be doing. We have our Best Science Medicine course coming up in 2018 in Vancouver, May 4th and May 5th. Continue to check out Tools for Practice because, Mike, as far as I know, people are still writing them.
Yes. Yeah. Some people are. I've given up.
Yes. Yeah. So there's lots of those coming out, at least one every couple of weeks. And they're gems, if you will.
Yes.
And check out our website. Feel free to leave comments on iTunes. Email us some questions. We haven't done a question and answer podcast for, I think, decades now. But we do personally get back to people most of the time, I think, about answering questions, even if we don't bring them up on a podcast. So, I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.